Hello there and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, where this weekly Maurice Gohan is spreading the body positivity and Rob Long is looking for a happy ending. And even if you hate the phrase deep dive, that's exactly what Aoife Gallagher will be doing into The Colour Blue. But first off, comedian and writer Maurice Gohan isn't the only person who found the scales tipping against her following the long days and nights of lockdown. Nor is she the only one who's sorry not sorry about it. Now she's planning to do not do something about it.
Learning to love yourself and like learning to love your body is like that whole journey that I feel like every person, but more specifically women, have to go through. So I feel like doing this is a good way to kind of break through and kind of seal the last chapter of the learning to love and just loving.
During lockdown, I did ab exercises every single day. I tried intermittent fasting, where I only ate between the hours of 12 and 8. I took long walks almost every single day. I drank grapefruit juice mixed with apple cider vinegar because I read some blog that it was good for you. I still gained weight. Post-lockdown, I'm still gaining it. I live inside a perpetual circle of gaining and losing weight. My friends used to call me Oprah because I'm always yo-yoing, up and down on the scale. And I wish I didn't care about it. It's so superficial. I pretend I don't care. It's too cliched. I'll say things like, how I look doesn't define me. What I think is more important. But if I got 3 wishes from a genie, one would be to have a flat stomach. And I feel ashamed of that. It's not very feminist of me. The other two would be world peace and an end to hunger, just so we're clear. I am a good person, just a terribly insecure good person. I know why I gain weight too. I love to eat. I look through cookery books like men do porn. Ah, a breast of chicken and sticky sauce. Oh, yes, please. I spend hours planning recipes every week. I visit the grocery shop every day. I love cooking. I really love eating. Nothing makes me happier than going to bed on an uncomfortably full stomach. It makes me feel like a Roman king. I am able to logically acknowledge how much joy food brings me, but I still want a flat stomach. I buy dresses a size too small. I'll grow into it, I tell myself, eating my cheese board at 11 p.m. Tomorrow, it's all changing tomorrow. I'm not alone in this elusive quest for skinny. My best friend Fiona has had one goal for the entire time I've known her, which is to get under 10 stone. She was at 10 stone 1 pound for 3 weeks and contemplated cutting off her hair just to get to that elusive scale number. We're all stuck in this trap. When I was a kid, the beauty standard was stick thin. Kate Moss, heroin chic. How unrealistic to want women to look like little kids. I remember being 9 years old and looking in the mirror thinking, oh great, I look like the women in the magazines. I'm golden. I had the ideal woman's body in the 90s when I was 9 years old. But in the past 20 years, that has changed. We're no longer expected to be stick-thin creatures. What a relief. Now we just have to have tiny waists and a big bum. Oh, much more realistic. We're Irish. We're not programmed for that. We're a country of long backs. So the beauty standards have switched, but they're still as unattainable as they've always been. I'm starting to think beauty standards are designed to make us feel inadequate. They're designed to make us always feel less than. There has been one time that I've had a flat stomach since I was 9 years old. I posted a photo on Instagram in a bikini, got 60 likes. A week later, I was committed in a psych ward. Everyone kept complimenting how good I looked. Whatever you're doing, it's working. Keep doing it. And I was like, gee, thanks. I haven't eaten a vegetable in 2 weeks and I'm completely miserable and void of feeling. When I'm at my most depressed, I'm also at my skinniest. Soon as I feel myself getting happier, I'm like, oh great, time to buy a bigger size of jeans. Happiness is 100% worth having to loosen your belt buckle, but there are times I question it. So how do I combat it? How do I make myself not want to be thin? I know logically what I think and how I act is so much more important. I know my worth is determined by the type of person I am, not my dress size. I know being skinny doesn't make you happy. But all that knowing doesn't seem to matter. I really think the only way I'm going to be happy with my fat little belly is if we, as a society, start treating bellies like we do boobs. The bigger the better. Lust after them. Censor them. Put them in bras.
Maurice Gohan there. Don't forget, if you haven't heard it yet, the latest Culture File debate featuring Alex Ross, Zalia Sava, Gregory Cole and Christopher Riopelle is on the long history of cultural cancellations, and it's now available to listen to in all the usual places, from the Lyric site all the way to Spotify, where you can find it by just searching for Culture File. Now, what colour was your Friday? How about Saturday? And Tuesday? Assuming you assign a colour to days of the week, Culturefile's Aoife Gallagher is among those who do. She discerns Tuesdays as blue. This set Aoife off on the trail of colours, a quest for their meaning and place in the order of things, and of course, research into the real significance of that very key question. What's your favourite colour?
Clearly one of the most important things, and I think this is what you're picking up on with this kind of question about what's your favourite colour, is that colour has great affective significance. So we place a lot of value in colours. We think a lot about the way in which we decorate our houses, the clothes that we wear in the morning. And those kind of associations, I think, are really important.
I've always seen Tuesday in a blue hue, and it's my favourite day in our week. In atmosphere. Calm, measured, efficient. You get stuff done on a Tuesday and you don't need to broadcast it. Or you get nothing done and you don't feel guilty for it. There are no social events, no FOMO, no family, friend, dinners that you're obliged to. It's all for you, Tuesday. And for me, it's blue. Blue has, I think, always been my favourite colour. Although I toyed with green for a few years. Because blue is a bit uninteresting to be a favourite colour, is it not? But when I reached my 20s and found faux self-security, I didn't need to keep up appearances. Hi, I'm boring, and my favourite colour is blue. I have a cup that I bought in a second-hand shop in Copenhagen a few years ago. I think it cost the same as my budget Ryanair flight there. Crazy that you could fly for the same price as a cup. Anyway, I happened upon this cup in a second-hand shop. 4 or 5 inches in height, and a handle which perfectly fits the average human hand. Of course, I like to believe that my hand fits it better than most, but of course it does not. There's an abstract image in blue and orange on the cup. It seems almost embossed, and I realise only now in describing it that the dense blue shape reminds me of the outline of Japan. This shape brings me low-level happiness daily, when filled with coffee in the morning time, which could be any hour from 7 to 11am, depending on which day of the week we're in. It's Tuesday today, so it was around the 9am call time for the cup. And the feeling outside is blue.
One kind of concern that people have about colours is that colours appear to vary across different conditions, but also between different perceivers. Coloured objects also appear differently to different perceivers, so colourblind people are an obvious example of that. I'm Keith Allen, Senior Lecturer at the University of York. I work on the philosophy of colour and the philosophy of perception more generally. And one of the questions that I'm interested in as a philosopher is what colours are, and indeed whether colours exist at all.
Have you lived here?
Is there a good reason to suppose that when we look at a coloured object and we see it one way and someone who's colourblind sees it a slightly different way, are we correct in thinking that we're getting it right and they're getting it wrong? So this all puts pressure on the idea that there's kind of objective colours out there, that objects have these colours that we're trying to pick up on, and that actually, kind of in the normal course of our lives, we're perceiving correctly. So there's kind of a couple of ways that you can respond to this kind of problem. So one is to think of colours in completely different terms. So think of colours in terms of the physical properties of things, so for instance the ways in which they're reflecting light. Another more drastic response is to think that objects aren't coloured at all, just colours don't exist out there in the world, so apples aren't red. The 17th century English philosopher John Locke thinks of colours as dispositions to produce sensations. So when we look at, say, a blue object, what happens is we have a certain kind of experience. We have this sensation of blue, and all it really is for something to be coloured is for the object to have a disposition to bring about that sensation. So this isn't saying that colours don't exist out there in the external world, and it's also not trying to say that colours are identical with reflectances or something like that, some kind of physical property. It's rather introducing this kind of relational mind-dependent property, so that on this account colours exist out there in the world, but they only exist in the world because we exist and we perceive them a certain way. So what it is for something to be blue just depends entirely upon its ability to produce a blue sensation in us.
I spoke with Keith in an attempt to glean more of an understanding about my understanding of colour. So this blue sensation seems to be particularly present in my wardrobe on my Tuesdays. But is this just something I acquired a habit for? Or do I, in fact, have an inherent attraction to that shade of colour? Perhaps I am entirely under the influence of blue branding. Once the royal colour and then the working man's colour. Now the colour of NAF nightclubs and Gillette razors for women. Key players in the fight for gender equality. So I asked a 3-year-old I know about her experiences with colour to see if her thoughts on the subject might shed some light on the early stages of colour appreciation. She seemed a bit more interested in my microphones than colour discussion.
What is that thing for?
It's a microphone.
What is that?
Do you know what a microphone is?
Yeah.
What is it?
I don't know.
No.
Speaker?
Speaker. Close. Tell me your name again.
Lily.
And I have blue eyes. I have blue eyes too, do I?
No.
What colour are my eyes?
Green.
Green? Are they?
Yeah.
I would have said they were blue. Look again.
Blue.
Blue, yeah? What about the plant? Is that blue? What colour is that?
Green.
What about the walls? What colour are they?
Black.
Not black.
Yellow.
They're not yellow.
Orange!
Yeah, they're orange. Well done. Orange walls.
Orange walls? No, they aren't.
Am I wrong?
Yeah.
What do you think they are?
Black.
It's funny that we pester children to choose a favourite colour when maybe they're much more curious about the insides of an object than what the object looks like.
My view on this is that the way in which we perceive colour is probably actually quite similar. The way in which we then think about those experiences and the way in which we carve the world up and the way in which we describe things is going to vary, and it will vary between perceivers for various different reasons. For instance, depending on the language they speak, depending on their interests in the world, the kind of things that they do. The best way of finding out what colours are is by using your eyes. So there are various things that physics and psychology will tell you about the processes which allow us to perceive colours, but they don't really tell you what colours are. In order to know what colours are, you need to look around you and think about your experience and what it is you see.
They tell me how long
exploration thus far into this colour, shade, hue, whatever it is, has not made things any clearer to me in one sense. I'm still no closer to figuring out why blue is my favourite colour, or why I line it with Tuesdays, or why I tend to dress myself in a conglomerate of navy. So the daily morning coffee in my Danish cup with a royal blue embossing? Perhaps this blue is not contained to the surface, but rather it runs through the veins of the object. Maybe the cup was not rendered blue, but born blue.
And you're probably looking at blue in a very broad sort of way, you know, a kind of very general way.
Yeah. I decided to speak with someone who knows blue objects in a way which I do not. Jack Doherty is a ceramicist from Derry, and one day, some weeks ago, via Zoom, he shared his thoughts on blue with me. From his studio in Cornwall, he told me of a very specific shade of blue which has preoccupied him for many years now.
I'm interested in a particular type of blue, and it's a blue that goes way back in history to the ancient Egyptians and to a style of work they made called faience, which is a name given to a type of self-glazing ceramic that was used for making anything from beads to amulets to kind of tomb figures for the royal families. And it's a particular type of almost turquoise. It's a sort of sky colour, and the Egyptians would have seen it as being, if you like, reflecting light, reflecting the sun, and also kind of revealing glimmers of the eternal. And it's a very optimistic colour, I think. And these times, I mean, I kind of look at it sometimes and I'm thinking, well, hey, wow, you know, sometimes we do need to have particular little flashes or insights into things which are kind of beyond the normal, beyond the everyday.
It's the colour of our world, our earth, the sea, the sky. Or is it? Blue is actually the colour that appears least in nature, the great blue illusion. There are no blue foods, and less than 10% of flowers are blue. When blue does present in nature, it's not a pigment, it's a reflection. Not coming from within, but sitting on the surface. Animals' clothing, their fur, skin and feathers are pigmented by the food they consume. For example, goldfinches get their yellow feathers from the yellow flowers they eat. It's a straightforward cycle. But this is not the case with blue. You're probably familiar with a butterfly emoji on your phone. It's blue to depict the very beautiful blue morpho butterfly. This creature's wing scales are shaped in ridges that cause sunlight to travel in such a way to our eye that we see it as blue light. If these scales were even slightly different, the blue would disappear. There is one exception to this rule, and that is the Obrina olive wing butterfly. A true blue, the only creature in nature known to produce blue pigment. So it seems animals have evolved in ways to trick our eyes into seeing blue. What reason for this? Maybe it's a poison warning signal, or a method of seduction, or simply a means to stand out in the crowd. Maybe we're all using it in much the same way.
I think that it's a signature colour of mine. In China, they call it Jack Blue. For me, the colour is integral. I mean, it's an integrated part of the form. It's not something that's added on separately. It kind of, if you like, it grows from the form itself. And the way that I work very, very simply now. I'm gradually over years abandoning a lot of things. And I work with one clay. I just use one colouring material and one firing to make this work. So it's kind of very, very focused. The world doesn't need ceramics. It doesn't need handmade objects, particularly in a practical way. You know, everything that we kind of used to use them for is done by different materials now. So my search really has been to find a place for the work I do in some way. And the starting point for it is always, you know, the history of ceramics, for me, is about the domestic. It's about the way that people live with objects, the way they've needed them to survive. From the earliest times, you know, we used clay objects to kind of cook in, we used clay objects to store things in. Ceramics allowed people to change their lifestyle from being nomadic to being stationary, to being becoming farmers, to be able to store grain from one season to the next. So I look at the function of things in a slightly different way, a more emotional way. I mean, I look at some of the biggest pieces I make as being, if you like, the sort of vessels that hold and guard us, that kind of keeping safe emotion. And they're the big things that you can put your arms around. They're big enough to hold on to and hang on to if you need to. And I make cups, things to drink from, and a little vessel form that you can hold. It's the shape of your fingers and your hands that contains colour, it contains texture and surface. As you drink from it, you feel the form of it as you're holding it.
So my blue cup doesn't just look blue, but it feels blue. It embodies blue. And when I hold it, this activates a sensation for me that, due to my very unique collection of personal experience, makes me feel happy, calm, content. Blue.
Anya Gallagher there in the zone. So what's your blue thing, that object that just holding it stills the world? We'd love to see them all, and not necessarily just the blue ones, also the yellows, the pinks, the whites even. Send us a photo, either on Twitter, tagging at culturefilepod, or via email to culture@rte.ie. And finally, this time on the Culture File Weekly, we welcome a new correspondent who'll be reporting for us on the US storytelling industrial complex. But who better to explain than the writer himself, Rob Long, in his very first Culture File Martini Shot.
This is Rob Long with Martini Shot. I call these little stories I tell, stories about Hollywood and the media, about living and working in the entertainment business, I call them martini shots because when you're filming a movie or a television show, when it's the last shot of the day, someone will call out, "This is the martini shot," and that means exactly what it sounds like. When this shot is done, you get your martini. The martini shot is the last shot, the happy ending to a long day of production. I've worked in Hollywood as a scriptwriter and producer for 30 years, and one of the rules I've learned is it's good storytelling, and it's good business too, to remember that whenever it's at all possible, deliver a happy ending. If at all plausible, and even if it's a real stretch of the imagination and credulity and sometimes relies on the sheer forgetfulness of the audience, make sure the guy and the girl end up together. Make sure the house doesn't burn down. Make sure the earth is saved, the hero triumphs, the wedding comes off, the warring partners are reconciled, and the dog comes home dirty but happy. Audiences, in my experience, will forgive a lot of things. A boring opening, a slow middle. But they want an ending to feel like a cymbal clash, a champagne cork popping, the satisfying sound of a book you've really enjoyed, plopping shut. I went to a screening once, and when the movie was over, I turned to my companion and I said, "What just happened?" "I was going to ask you the same thing," he said. And a few weeks later, when the movie opened in the theaters, the audiences agreed it was a terrible ending. So the movie didn't last long. Because it's human nature to want a happy or at least a satisfying ending, even more so when every day the front page of the newspaper seems to announce more and more complicated and irrational plot twists, and we're all getting the bad feeling that this particular movie isn't even close to being over. Meeting up with friends recently, we all did that now familiar dance. Are we using the masks? Are we not using the masks? Are we shaking hands? Are we bumping elbows? Where are we in this coronavirus movie? In the middle? Near the end? When do we get to get up and get out of this movie theater? We try hardest to make sense of things, I think, when they make no sense at all. But in this case, I guess the only thing to learn is you've got to take your happy endings where you find them. So before you go to bed at night, try to make sure the guy and the girl do get together. The house doesn't burn down. The family is reconciled. And the dog does come home, whatever that means for you in your life. Because real life, as opposed to movie life, often delivers up unwelcome plot twists. In the movie version of the world today, there's a research scientist somewhere who has discovered a vaccine for the virus. There's a solution coming in the next scene for climate change and ethnic strife and poverty and the reason why we all need those separate and different charger cables for our phones and things. You know, the big stuff. Speaking for myself, I'm ready for the martini shot to get called on a lot of this stuff. Although, there's a name for the shot that comes right before the martini shot, by the way. It's called the Abby Singer shot, named after the first assistant director of a production who mistakenly called out the martini shot when there was still one shot left to do. He was, of course, roundly despised and shunned for weeks because once you have your heart set on that martini shot and maybe the actual martini to come right after it, learning that there's still a little bit more to do just feels like a deeply unsatisfying, deeply unhappy ending. And as we all know, those are the worst. So let's hope, for a lot of what we're experiencing these days, that someone calls the martini shot soon. And that's it for this week. Next week, we will get famous. Sort of. This is Rob Long.
As the man said, that was Rob Long with his martini shot, another of which he'll be calling for us next week on Culture File. Speaking of which, we're back again with weekday Culture File on Monday at 6:10 p.m. and the next edition of the Culture File Weekly goes out next Saturday at 6:30 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, or then, bye now.